from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Defense on behalf of four female soldiers who fought in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. Two of the women were awarded Purple Hearts for their combat work. Many women end up in battle, but the military still technically bars women from most direct ground combat. The women bringing the suit say that lack of recognition is limiting their potential to be promoted. What role should women play on the battlefield? And do gender differences matter during war? Our guests will include the staff attorney with the ACLU, one of the plaintiffs, and a woman who was a U.S. Army chaplain who co-wrote Women in Combat, Civic Duty, or Military Responsibility. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, the ACLU filed a lawsuit in San Francisco U.S. District Court against the Department of Defense, challenging a policy in place since 1994, which excludes women in the armed forces from direct combat positions. The suit was filed on behalf of four women, two of whom received Purple Hearts for injuries sustained in combat. Over 14% of military personnel and 20% of the recruits in the armed forces presently are women. Some 85% who have served since 2001 were in combat zones, and half were in combat operations. Should the ban excluding women from most direct combat positions and impeding them from being promoted be lifted? And what role should women play on the battlefield? And do gender differences matter during war? We want to take all that up in this forum hour as we focus on women in combat. Joining us in studio is Elizabeth Gill, staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California, representing not only the four plaintiffs, but the Service Action Network. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program. We also want to welcome Zoe Bedell, who is with us by phone this morning from New York City. She's a Marine captain and one of the four plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the Department of the of Defense. And Zoe Bedell, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Reverend Marie DeYoung, who is joining us this morning from Eunice, Louisiana. She's a former chaplain, former commander in the U.S. Army, also the author of Women in Combat, Civic Duty, or Military Responsibility. Welcome, Reverend Marie DeYoung.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you all here. And I thought I'd begin with Elizabeth Gill here in studio. There is another case pending that has not gone through a second lawsuit, but this one is based on, well, the Constitution, I guess, really, isn't it, for the most part?
Absolutely. You know, we're representing, as you said, four service women and also the Service Women's Action Network, a nonprofit organization that works with active service women and veterans in a variety of capacities. And they've come forward to challenge this so-called combat exclusion policy in a federal lawsuit against the Secretary of Defense. And the Department of Defense policy, as you said, prohibits women from being assigned to units that engage in direct ground combat. And the effect of that policy is to exclude women from even competing for whole career fields within the armed services, such as infantry, and from hundreds of thousands of individual positions, regardless of their qualifications or capabilities.
The rule, the exclusion rule, was written by Les Aspin back when he was Secretary of Defense in 1994.
That's correct. The rule has been in place and is largely the same since 1994.
And we have a very different kind of warfare now. That's part of really the reasoning or rationale here, isn't it?
That is exactly what I think the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have shown us that there really are no front lines in the modern battlefield. And it's especially true today that the policy simply doesn't match up with the reality of modern warfare. Women are serving in combat roles, as you mentioned. Just serving in Iraq and Afghanistan is to some extent to serve in a combat zone. But also, as Captain Bedell can tell us, women are being attached to ground combat units and going out and serving with the men in these combat units. They simply can't get the same recognition that the men are getting for the same service that the men are doing, and that, you know, is causing harms in a variety of ways.
Well, let's bring Captain Bedell into the conversation here. Zoe Bedell, Marine captain and one of the four plaintiffs. I guess I was reading another Marine captain's woman, Marine captain, who said, you know, I was in a Humvee and an IED went off and it didn't know that I wasn't in combat. That kind of encapsulates, I suppose, your position, doesn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. I was in charge of a group called the Female Engagement Team. So I had 46 Marine women whose mission was to engage with Afghan women. And so to do this, and Afghans generally, not just women, but to do this, the sense that they were patrolling every day, sometimes twice a day, with infantry units. So they were in these remote corners of Afghanistan, and they were going out, and they were going through villages, and they were meeting people, and they were patrolling with the infantry every day. And I assure you, the Taliban or whatever insurgents were out there that day did not wait to see what the gender was of the people on the patrol. My Marines were absolutely engaged by enemy forces, and they returned fire, and they fought back, just like they would be expected to do, and just like all the male Marines around them did.
You were accompanying this male infantry living under identical conditions and working conditions similar, if not the same.
Exactly. No, these were very small bases. Bases probably too big of a word. You know, sometimes there were, you know, maybe 15 to 20 Marines on this base, and my two female Marines with them. So they had maybe a tent or two and very sparse conditions, and my Marines did their whole deployment out in these conditions.
I realize that the concern here was the limited recognition and the impediments with respect to promotion, but some of the arguments we hear, and we'll hear from Mervyn DeYoung on this, are that this exclusion works to the benefit of women because when men are with women in brutal situations like this, it can lead to rape or the other side of the coin. But there are a number of women getting pregnant much higher when they're on these kind of missions but and deployed. But the other thing is that men tend to be more chivalric also, so the argument goes, and are more concerned about women, and it impedes the effort, the war effort.
Well, let me address a couple of those points there. There was a whole bunch in there. So first of all, yes, the big portion of the suit is about, you know, making sure that women have equal opportunities and are recognized for the work that they're already doing. But another portion of it is making sure that our military is the best fighting force it can possibly be. And this policy is preventing that right now. So, for example, the commanders don't have the opportunity to choose the best people for the jobs. They can choose men if it happens to be a job that might involve combat. In my experience, for example, with the female engagement team, we had to constantly do this delicate balancing game to decide what missions we could support and in what capacity. And frankly, every commander had to interpret the role slightly differently. So it was not uniform. No one was ever really comfortable with how we were allowed to be employed. And there were missions that people would just sort of arbitrarily decide we couldn't go on, which is not for the benefit of the force out there. So it's really about giving the military a chance to pick the best people for the job and make sure that the best people are in the roles. As for the issue of sexual assault, that is absolutely an issue. You're correct. It's an issue across the military, and I would say it's not just women who are being sexually assaulted, but it's men. And if you look at the absolute numbers, there's higher numbers of men being assaulted than women, that the rates for women are higher. And that is absolutely a problem, and it needs to be addressed. But the response to this is not to just pull women out of these situations. You know, that's a response that we've seen in societies like Iran or Saudi Arabia, where women are just excluded from the public dialogue, from the national participation in sort of the nation. And that's not really what we do here. And that sort of paternalism, frankly, just isn't allowed by the Constitution, though, of course, Elizabeth could speak a little bit more about that. Furthermore, I would argue that the policy actually contributes to this culture where sexual assault is acceptable to the extent that it's tolerated, because it's a policy that the organization says women are not full members of this organization. They are not able to fully contribute. We don't think they're qualified. So if the organization is putting out that message, why would any individual need to think differently? Certainly a lot of individuals do, but that if for those individuals that don't want to, the organization is there reinforcing their ideas that women can't hang.
But what about that other argument, though, that men are apt to be more deferential toward women, some men, of course, on the battlefield, and it might put them more in harm's way? Plus, you could add to that the fact, and it often has been added in the argument, that men are simply, by and large, physically stronger, and if somebody has to be dragged off, I mean, it's like you don't have women out there on the gridiron playing football or playing hockey, so the argument goes, physical strength has to be on the battlefield. You have to drag somebody, let's say, to safety, and it could be done easier or better by men than women, so the argument would go?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me address the chivalry issue first. And I think the best response to that is that women are on the battlefield, they are in combat situations, and once the bullets start flying, everyone acts like they're trained to act. So when that training does not involve singling out women for extra protection, and I assure you none of my Marines either needed or received extra protection. Everyone responded exactly like they were supposed to, male and female, and engaged with the enemy and neutralized the situations as necessary. So, I think, again, that's a very outdated situation, but in these outdated concept of how people respond, and the reality suggests that people respond by doing what they were trained to do. When everyone has been properly trained, everyone responds properly. As for the issue of strength, strength is absolutely important on the battlefield, as are many other characteristics, including ability to make quick decisions under high-pressure situations, the ability to shoot straight. There are a lot of things that contribute to success in a combat environment, and women bring all those things to the table, including strength. There are absolutely women who have the strength required to do the job. So let them compete, the women who aren't strong enough, and granted, the men who aren't strong enough, because right now, the rule allows men in regardless of their strength, just based on the fact that they're men. So we're looking to even the playing field so that everyone has a chance to compete on their merits and what they bring to the table, which is not what is happening right now.
Zoe Bedell, again with us from New York, Marine captain, one of the four plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the Department of Defense. And Reverend Marie DeYoung is a former chaplain, former commander in the U.S. Army, and also co-author of Women in Combat, Civic Duty or Military Responsibility. And let's go back to 1992 for a moment with you, Reverend DeYoung. You were back in 1992 serving actually on the Presidential Commission, which was studying gender differences and found, as I understand it, overwhelming differences in terms of just gender performance.
No. I wrote a book based on extensive research. I served as the first woman chaplain in a number of ground combat units. And what I wrote about is ground combat. It's not about being attached to a group that wanders through and is trying to engage in social relations. Granted, that is dangerous work, absolutely. But ground combat, it's like the difference between ping pong and playing football. I'm talking about the units where the grunts are doing close-up physical fighting, and that's their primary mission, okay? I think Zoe is absolutely right. If you had equal standards, and I think you'll notice that the Marine Corps has finally said that in 2014 they're going to have equal physical standards for women. If you have equal standards for women, and women can meet those equal standards, the odds are pretty good. If they are not previous victims of sexual assault or sexual violence, if they meet the physical training, the height and weight and all of that, and if they have a background that's predisposed to very aggressive fighting, that they could possibly achieve that. There have been recent tests. They just had, didn't they just have recently a Marine officer infantry course? Not one woman passed it. When I advocated for equal standards, there were a number of congressional aides who were high-ranking military officers who didn't even bat an eyelash when they said, if we do that, we'll have very, very few women in the military.
Well, there is also the argument, I suppose, and perhaps it's yours, you can codify this, that one woman's inclusion is another woman's exemption. Would you say, just from your experience, that the majority of women would like to see equality across the board with respect to ground combat?
I think that the studies showed then and the studies show now, and the proof is in the pudding. You say we have 14% women serving in active duty. In the 90s, when we first started going to war, we had 21%. The numbers have gone down drastically when we've been in a wartime environment. All of the research shows that, in fact, women do not want to be in ground combat. That's not why they sign up. They sign up to do something of service. And they're promised usually career paths where they're going to be doing nursing, where they're going to be doing administration, finance, things like that. There are adventurers who want to fly pilots. I've been with combat pilots who are male and female. I've been with military police and whatnot. It's not the same job. But usually in the military police units, the women meet exactly the same standard as men.
And do you have the concern that I alluded to before about men perhaps acting chivalrous on the battlefield and that impeding the war efforts?
No, Michael, I'm glad you raised that, because that's an argument of some extreme right-wing people who are very out of date in their understanding of how men and women should behave. I don't think that's the case at all. It's been my experience both in the 1980s when I was a commander and ran extensive social service programs for the military, as well as in the 90s, being in Korea as a deputy command chaplain of the 19th TACOM, being in the 4th Infantry Division, the brigade chaplain, aviation support, the 2nd Infantry Division, there are few women and mostly men, 1,200 men. It's been my experience that men will respect you if you just do your job. That has been my experience. Not trying to do workarounds, not using your sexuality in order to get favors. The men are very respectful. We've all gotten great ratings. We've gotten the support that we need to get promoted at the right time. That will happen. The people who are antiquated, sure, they should be put out of the military altogether. It's not happening. They tend to be in corps like the chaplain corps, one of the few areas in the military where officers are allowed to exercise their prejudices based on their faith, you know. But as far as the regular officers are concerned, it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened. People have earned their right. We have a 4-star woman general in the Army. Why? She earned her way to the top.
And do you think that this follows a certain kind of logic, as apparently it does in many people's minds? You desegregated the troops for race. You had Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And now you have pretty much equal rights for gays and lesbians to be open about their identity. And in the,
uh-huh.
I mean, does that follow logically here, or is this a different case?
No, it doesn't follow logically, because when you're talking about gay or straight, African-American versus white versus Asian versus Hispanic or whatever, what you're basically talking, and when you're talking about male or female, you're talking about who fits the physical profile of doing that kind of fighting. Goodness, I'm a teacher now. You don't put kids who weigh 120 pounds fighting against people who are 150. At the time when I wrote this book, women who were billions champions were arguing against playing against men in billiards in the national championships because, quote, we'll never win. They're too much stronger than us. Now, here's the other argument as far as the Constitution is concerned. Until now, the Supreme Court has always ruled in favor of the Ferris Doctrine. And what that is about is basically saying we're not getting involved in the military's business because the military has never been a place that is about absolute equality or whatever. It's about efficiency, getting the job done with the least expense, the fewest troops put in harm's way as possible.
And I just want to reiterate here that, you know, what we're
Elizabeth
seeking,
Gill from the ACLU.
Yep, sorry, Elizabeth Gill from the ACLU. What we're seeking in this lawsuit is that the lawsuit is challenging the blanket ban that's excluding women from opportunities. We recognize absolutely that combat duty requires a special set of skills from both men and women, and not every woman will want or be able to serve in that capacity. Not every man will either. But each and every service member should be evaluated on their individual merits. And it's been the experience of our plaintiffs in this case, who all have engaged in ground combat in some capacity, that, you know, they are capable and qualified of serving, and they're simply not getting the career opportunities. And I think, you know,
forgive me, didn't Secretary Panetta just open 14,000 jobs to women recently? I mean, this suit is against him, essentially. It's against the Department of Defense.
Yes, and that's a welcome step. But to put that in perspective, you know, opened 14,000 new positions, but 238,000 positions remain closed.
What and are those 238,000 positions?
They are across the armed services, and they include entire career fields. So, yes, it's the case that there are some
what
women.
What career fields other than infantry? I don't understand, because I know officers who have served in field artillery. I know officers who have been combat pilots. I don't understand. There's a very narrow ban, and the narrow ban is against the ground combat position. We're talking about the grunt work where you carry 75 to 150 pounds on your back, walk through the woods 25 miles with that pack on your back, don't have bathrooms, don't have places where you can change your tampons discreetly. That's what we're talking about.
Well, and I'll let Captain
Well, this does, excuse me, this does ban, I think you're saying, Elizabeth Gill, this bans an entire class, though.
Absolutely. It bans a whole career field, hundreds of thousands of positions. And actually, I want to make the point that more than that, as Captain Bedell said earlier, and I would like her to speak to her experience because she left active duty due to this combat exclusion and the impediments to her career advancement in the military. But beyond that, the combat exclusion policy is doing a lot more damage than preventing women from just being assigned to ground combat units. It is, it's causing harm in all kinds of capacities. It's not letting women get credit for the combat service they are doing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I don't understand. They get credit on their OER. Maybe the Marines has a problem. That is a possibility.
Both the Army and the Marines, combat, officially recognized combat, is seen as a key stepping stone to career advancement.
Hold that thought for a moment because I want to give out the phone number. We're coming toward the break here, and I know there are going to be a lot of listeners who will want to join in this conversation who have questions or comments or just simply want to voice whatever their concerns are here, and you can join us now toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. We do welcome your calls, and feel free to contribute to the conversation here by joining us at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or you can post questions or comments right directly on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. There is a RAND study, by the way, that says these rules are being violated. I think we have to keep that into consideration, Reverend DeYoung, don't we? That right now, in fact, there are women in combat, in ground combat, in positions that they are supposedly excluded from.
Every violation is very expensive. It's very, very expensive. Because, you know, as I'm sure the captain will tell you, the rates in the units, once you go into the mixed combat zones, rates of pregnancy are much higher. The rates of women dropping out. The cost, this is a fact, the cost, okay, not just to the military, but to the woman. Because as the RAND studies will tell you, as other medical studies will tell you, once a woman, if she's joined the military to get an education, to take the $60,000 of college money or whatever, is promised a job that is relatively secure, and now all of a sudden she's placed, plucked into a ground combat unit as an experiment, whether it be attached as a medical or attached as maybe some kind of commo person, what happens is the rates in those specific units of pregnancy, sexual harassment, et cetera, all those things go up.
All right, I'm against a hard break here, and I wanted Captain Bedell wanted to say something here. Zoe Bedell.
I mean, this is a very insulting argument, line of reasoning, that women can't handle themselves and they can't make their own decisions about how they want to serve their country, and that, you know, the Secretary of Defense should be allowed to decide how a woman wants to look after her own body. I think those arguments are very offensive and really not backed up by the evidence.
They are backed up by the evidence, and it's not at all insulting. This is about money. This is about life. When a woman joins the military for one reason and is forced because people are trying to accommodate a policy without actually having to give into it, forced to go to an assignment that she did not plan on, what happens when she becomes pregnant is, number one, she has to
first
be
of all
replaced.
No one is
number two
women
she has to be
combat
number
anymore
two. Number two,
we're talking over each other, and we're also coming up on a break, so I'm going to have to ask that we come back to this when we return. And by the way, you can join us, you can post your questions or comments again on our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, or tweet us. Twitter handle is @kqedforum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, women in combat. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Defense on behalf of four female soldiers who fought in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, and two of the women were awarded Purple Hearts for their combat work. Many women end up in battle, but the military still technically bars women from most direct ground combat. The women bringing the suit say they lack recognition, and it's limiting their potential to be promoted. We're asking, what role should women play on the battlefield, and do gender differences matter during war? And that question was asked to about 53,000 troops under General James Amos, a survey that we're still waiting for the results of. Of course, the military branches often operate with the idea of command and control, very much a part of the culture. And this lawsuit really, in many respects, is challenging that. I'm looking at some emails that are, many of them coming in from you and comments on our website. Let me just give a sample of what we're hearing from our listeners, and then we'll go to your calls. This is from Eric, who writes, I spent 25 years in the military, officer and enlisted. The bottom line is, can the individual do the job? Doesn't matter whether the issue is race, as in the 40s, sexual orientation, more recently, gender identity. Can the person do the job? I was very proud to be the first aircraft commander in my squadron to integrate a woman into our combat aircrew back in the 90s. Chris writes, I'm a combat veteran, have the highest respect for women in uniform. I have seen them fight and hold their own as any other man when inadvertently placed in a combat role. The only stipulation I would place is that they meet the same physical requirements as men in order to serve in active combat roles. This either means that the standards overall are lowered to the current women PFT standards or allow qualified women who can meet the man standards to serve. I felt the same about hair standards, but that is different. David from Facebook says, as a human being, I do not think women or men should be in harm's way. As a feminist, I think any woman who wants to be there should be. And Beth from our web page writes, seems like common sense. If a woman can do all a man does in the military, including combat, then as citizens under the equal protection laws, they should be able to be in active combat unless pregnant. And Liz says, is our much-vaunted professional army incapable of staying on mission during combat when accompanied by female colleagues? That question is asked with some irony perhaps behind it. Let me go back, if I may, to Zoe Bedell. And Captain Bedell, moment ago, we heard Elizabeth Gill talk about your story. I want to go to our callers and find out what they have to say on this, but give us a little sense about how your story figures into this.
Well, I think my story figures in a lot of ways. First of all, having been in charge of a group of female Marines who are out patrolling and doing all these things and ending up in combat situations, I think I have a pretty good perspective on, you know, both what women are actually doing in these environments right now and how well they're performing. You know, furthermore, I left active duty about a year ago because of this policy. You know, it would be my assignment to future positions would be determined based on my gender rather than my qualifications and my past performance. And that just didn't make sense for me professionally. And frankly, I don't think it makes sense for the military in the sense that they are losing perfectly qualified people who are frustrated with the fact that they are being treated as second-class citizens.
All right, I'm looking at our callers, and right now all of the callers who are lined up are men. I want to encourage women to call in or at least to be heard here. And, of course, you could be heard in other ways than calling in. You can go to our Facebook page and post comments there or our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum. Let's go to our callers. And first up here in the queue is Ryan. Ryan, join us.
Hey, Michael. How are you today?
Thank you. Okay.
You know, I guess I'm calling, and kind of the common theme here is that the woman needs to be able to do the job just as the man. And I would, you know, obviously love to see women get as far as they can in the military. I think there's a lot of logistical things that come up, one of them being, you know, like you said, the sexual stuff, whether you're in combat or out of combat. I have friends that are in the military that say that, you know, sexual relations happen on a regular basis. The other thing is that, you know, if these women can truly pass the test, if they can truly carry that pack, if they can truly engage in the military role that the men that they're fighting next to and that are depending on them can do, then fine. I don't know if that's going to be the case in most cases. The other thing is that I do think that each person, each, you know, gender plays a specific role, whether it be in the military or outside. And we want to push those limits as far as we can, but I just don't know if hand-to-hand combat is really something that women should be involved with. Again, maybe there's a subset of the population that can deal with that, but in general, as a general policy, I think that the higher-ups in the military should ultimately be making that decision. And it's unfortunate that the ACLU went forward with this particular lawsuit.
All right, Ryan, I thank you for the call. Elizabeth Gill, what about this argument based on competence? You know, if a woman can carry into 75 to 125 pounds or whatever it is on her back, or carry the weaponry along with that, or be in a tank, the kinds of things, hand-to-hand combat, if she can prove herself capable and competent, why not have that as a standard for both men and women?
You know, our lawsuit is challenging a blanket exclusion of women from these positions. We are just seeking a chance for women to compete and to prove that they're qualified and capable, which in the experience of our plaintiffs, they already have done. The problem with the ban is it doesn't allow women to even compete for any of these positions. And it's, you know, constraining commanders' hands on the ground. Their hands are tied. They can't put qualified and capable women who are serving on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan in these units due to the policy.
Let me get another caller on, and that's you, Bryce. Join us.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I am a former Marine of some 20 years ago now, but the concerns I have are twofold. And first is that while I, you know, like pretty much everybody else on the show, I fully support the idea of an equal opportunity. The problem is that in my experience, that always became a test of equivalency. For example, the basic physical fitness test and the scoring was completely different for women and men. For an example, the running timed portion of it was half the distance for women, but if they took longer time to run half the distance, but they got the same score and advanced in their career the same way. So as long as it's an actually equal standard, I think it's perfectly valid. And the other concern is what I'm hearing here, and was to your recent show about the book, The Generals, I'm concerned with sort of the careerist approach, because the trick has to be who really can get the job done and not they want recognition for something I've done that is related to something else to advance my career.
All right. I thank you for those comments. Appreciate your call, Bryce. I want to actually go back, if I may, to you, Reverend Rita Young. And Reverend Rita Young is co-author of Women in Combat, Civic Duty or Military Responsibility, with us this morning in Eunice, Louisiana. Let me just read a couple of emails here and get your responses, if I may, Reverend. Eric
sure.
writes, the former chaplain is so off base and offensive that it is laughable. I have known women, Army officers, physically stronger than most men I know. If they are willing to give up the physical comfort, privacy, et cetera, and they can do the job, then they are qualified to serve in combat. And Dennis says, this isn't a personal choice. If the woman chooses this, I say good for you. From the enemy's point of view, what does it matter? If the person shooting at you is gay, straight, bi, transgender, male or female, if you get hit, dead is dead. You would say what, Reverend?
I'd say what I said at the beginning. Have equal standards. Go ahead and put your money where your mouth is, ACLU, and all of the captains who are suing because they think they didn't get a promotion because of their gender. It's not true. Put yourself, if you want to be in ground combat, then fight to have equal physical fitness standards as men. That's a great starting point. And I guarantee you what will happen is in the same way that the war has caused the percentages of women in the military to decline from 20% down to 14%, we'll go down. In the 1990s, the Marine Corps had 4% women. They had the most stringent standards. We'll go down to 4% to 6% women across the board, but true, they will be fully qualified to be in combat.
All right, I want to bring a caller in from Montana. Richard, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I served in Vietnam in the quarter cap, 1st Infantry. I was wounded three times. The second time, a three-quarter ton truck was going north as my armored vehicle was going south. They hit a mine right beside me. I happened to be looking right at this E-6 who was blown up out of his vehicle and blown apart, and a piece of him hit me in the shoulder. And, you know, I was subsequently sent back and treated and all that. If that had been a woman, I would have been at the least ineffective for combat or for anything else for quite a while, even if it was a woman that I didn't know. Combat's not really that much about physical strength. It's more about emotional and moral strength. You have to deal with things like that on a regular basis. Now, if you have a mixed unit where people become very, very close and, you know, you have to look at women that you know, or if you're a woman, men that you're known, turned into pieces of carrion, it's just going to destroy you.
Well, there are, and Bryce, excuse me, Richard, I appreciate the call. I was just going to say there are statistics that reveal that women suffer more from PTSD, sure. Women who are exposed to combat. What do you say to that, Elizabeth Gill?
You know, there are a myriad of harms that this policy is inflicting, and I think, you know, one of them is that you know, women aren't necessarily getting the same resources as men. And so, you know, although women are, again, you know, to serve in Iraq and Afghanistan is to some extent to serve in a combat zone. But women aren't necessarily receiving the same training or training with the same units at the as the men are, in part due to the combat exclusion. So it's not just that the combat exclusion is preventing women from accessing entire career fields and all of these closed positions. It is doing that, but it's also really hampering how the military is operating and how women are able to do their jobs and what kind of training they're getting on the ground. And then I think that there's an effect even after women leave the service. And with PTSD is a good example. I mean, we're seeing, you could be a female veteran and you go into a VA office and the intake coordinator presumes that you have some kind of injury that's different from PTSD because you can't have served in a combat zone because you're a woman. And so I think you know, this is sort of part and parcel of you know, misunderstanding the role that women are really playing, and it's really about how this policy is totally outdated.
So you see the policy even related to the higher number of cases of PTSD among women?
No. The highest number the issue of PTSD with women is very complicated, and it hasn't changed. Because you still have, to a certain extent, an economic draft when it comes to women joining the military. The vast majority who join are joining to get a break in life. They come in with much, much higher rates of sexual trauma in their past, domestic violence in their past, child abuse in their past. And so the opportunities for them to, opportunities are a terrible choice of words, but the chance that they will be re-victimized, not just in wartime, but in peacetime, because military combat units, having served in many units, I can tell you, where men and women were integrated and slept side by side and did that work, they're very, very aggressive places to be. Peacetime or wartime.
Can I jump in there as well? I want to come here, Zoe Bedell. Go ahead.
Yes. So responding directly to the caller, I hate to say it, but unfortunately, my Marines did see people blown up. They did see their male peers blown up. And I was very lucky that none of my Marines suffered that sort of injury on this deployment. But it happened to other groups that followed us. There was recently a woman, female engagement team member, killed in Afghanistan. This is happening, and it is horrible, absolutely. But the evidence shows that they respond in the same ways as men. One of my, she's a sailor, actually. Not only did she see her friends blown up, but then she worked to save them. And this is the same story we hear over and over again. And I agree with the Reverend on this one, that women will come in with higher rates of previous victimization, but when that's controlled for, women display the PTSD symptoms at the same rates as men.
Captain Bedell, I want to get.
But it's an issue across the board for the whole military that we need to be addressing.
Well, what you have then is you have like 65-70% of women who are coming back with symptoms, active symptoms of PTSD, whereas with men it's 15-30%. Now, let's get away from the statistics. The gentleman caller was expressing some very chivalrous sentiments. The whole thing is confused at this point in time because, as far as sexuality is concerned or intimate relations, I mean, you know, the military has always had X percent of gay people. It's always had X percent of women who've been in the wings, in the shadow, or whatever. Those relationships, in his day, I think people were socialized very, very differently during the Vietnam War than they are now.
And I'd like to read
now
an email.
Men and women, as far as standing up for someone who's been injured, there's no doubt in my mind, men or women will act courageously and work to save lives. That's not the issue about whether or not they're fit to do this physically very aggressive hand-to-hand combat.
I actually want to read an email that came in from a therapist, a woman named Susan, who says, I'm a therapist who has worked with combat-related PTSD for many years. I have a close female friend, a combat nurse with severe PTSD 35 years after the war. I do not understand why anyone would want to go to war and then suffer this continuous horror for the rest of their lives. The men in Vietnam had no choice, but since then, it has all been choice over and over. I've heard men tell me, if only I had known. So with all this information, why would a woman who doesn't have want to go into a life of misery? As kids, we're taught, if you touch the hot stove, you get burned, and we learn to stay away. Stay
away. Can I please address that one, Michael?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Because I was laughed at in the 90s when I was raising the issue. Just take the issue of pregnancy. When a woman is on active duty, wartime or peacetime, she automatically becomes, automatically becomes high-risk pregnancy category. The stress of military life is such that it puts the life of her child, her future child, in danger. Now, in the 90s and now, we have
hold on here.
Yes, it is true. In the 90s and now, we had a critical shortage of teachers. Teaching is a far more compatible lifestyle for women of childbearing years. Far more compatible life. We don't offer any scholarships in the United States of America for women or men to become teachers. To get their college education for free, they have to join the military. That is a very sick American social policy, and we're the only country in the world that has that policy.
I think Zoe Bedell wanted to respond here, Captain Bedell.
You know what? I totally agree. We should definitely have scholarships for teachers. I think that's a great idea. But the fact is, we can't just force people to not have a choice. Whether or not you personally think it's a great choice, I mean, my parents might not have always agreed with my decision to join, but it was my choice, and I need to be free to make that, and women need to be free to make those choices.
Captain Bedell, can I get you to respond actually to an email here from a listener? I'd really like to hear what you have to say, given your combat experience. Rick says, I have two daughters, very special women. I want equality in all areas where it makes sense. I also have a son due to deploy in January to Afghanistan. I would never want to have my son put at higher risk in the name of gender equality. I could easily see an effort to equalize the gender representation in combat troops, leading to less qualified individuals put forward, thus putting all soldiers at risk. Mm-hmm. I remember reading, not sure of the validity, that the Navy was losing a higher than average number of female F-18 carrier pilots because they were being pushed to fill those spots while not being qualified. And what would you say to him, if you would, Captain?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one theme that we've been very consistent about. This certainly isn't about lowering standards. This is about improving the military. So we're certainly not getting into the exact ways that we want that to happen in the suit, and we think the DOD is probably best suited to make some of those specific decisions. But we agree. We want to make the military stronger. My Marines are still serving. I don't want to put anyone at more risk through any policy, but I think eliminating this policy will actually allow the commanders to choose the best people for the jobs and thus make our force stronger.
Well, we've got a listener who says, look to the Israeli military, how women perform in combat honorably and effectively. And let's go to more of our callers, and let's go to Chicago, Illinois. And Bill, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, first of all, I served in the Army National Guard Infantry and Mortars for 6 years, and absolutely, I think women should be able to fill any combat role they want to without exception. My question is why the ACLU is stopping halfway and not also pushing for the opening of selective service registration requirements to females as well. After all, my son will eventually have to register with selective service. If he chooses not to, he faces ineligibility for federal employment, a number of federal aid, student loans, things like that. Mm-hmm. Why not go all the way and make the selective service system also eligible to females? And I'll take my questions off.
All right, thank you for the question, Elizabeth Gill.
Sure. You know, this suit is, you know, a first step. It's challenging this blanket exclusion by the Department of Defense that applies to all of the service branches. And, you know, right now, women don't have a chance to, you know, compete. They don't have a chance to go to some of these schools. So I think, you know, we need to address the issue of the blanket ban and, you know, allowing positions to open up to some extent that, you know, commanders on the ground are ready to put people in positions now. They should be able to do that. And removing this particular barrier is a necessary step.
It's an incremental step, you're saying. That's how you envision it, as an incremental step.
You know, I don't think necessarily it has to be. You know, the Department of Defense, if it repeals this policy, you know, could demand an accounting from all of the branches as to how they are, you know, what positions they're excluding women from and how, you know, that that's mapping out in terms of the policy.
Well, but there has been a trajectory. I mean, back in the 90s, Congress lifted the ban on women flying attack aircraft and women are allowed in submarines. I mean, things have been moving along this direction. Let me get to another caller, though. We've got a caller joining us from Las Vegas. And Sarah, that's you. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I really appreciate the show. I just wanted to comment on the issue or the idea of choice. Do these women really have a choice? Women who have been abused in the past. I mean, are they really entering because it's their choice? I mean, what other choice do they have? Like you said, they want an education. They want to better their lives. And what other choice do they have? So I just want to comment on that and get your guys' thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, in many instances, I think the implication here is that a lot of women are compelled to go into the armed forces because they don't seem to see much light in their life for other sorts of vocations or other ways of finding a career. But,
may I address that?
Yeah, go ahead, Reverend.
What this boils down to is this lawsuit is challenging the Ferris Doctrine, which basically says that the military will make its decisions based on the needs of the military. And we would hope at a time when our country is going over a fiscal cliff that we would begin to make those decisions economically for a change, which we haven't been doing for the last 20 or 30 years, and try to find a way to have the fewest number of people put in harm's way as absolutely possible. That's the one issue. Women don't have a choice, but the Ferris Doctrine basically says men don't either. When I went through officers' candidate school, I had a choice. I picked my branch. I was a woman. They treated me like a princess and gave me every assignment I wanted. And I was always posted 2 grades above my rank. My job was always in the entire military, 2 grades above my rank. Okay? Men don't get that. If a man is physically qualified to be a grunt, they make him an 11 Bravo, an infantryman. If he's brilliant, they put him in the military intelligence corps. But he doesn't get that same choice.
Now here's a woman named Ramona who writes on our website, as a former woman Marine, I'm amazed and insulted at this leave it to beaver mentality that women are still the lesser counterpart of the military. The military is still the only organization in this country allowed to legally discriminate against women in the workplace, and it's shameful. Joseph says, even federal law enforcement, which is well integrated with women, are selective when placing women in dangerous undercover assignments because of sexual assault situations. And Michelle says, I don't understand why it's a woman's problem that she's more likely to be raped. This is an issue that should be handled with the rapport and culture of the military. It's about getting the job done. And Shankar says, please ask the lady from the military why it's okay to force a man to take on combat duties that he didn't bargain for, but not ask the same of a woman if that indeed happens.
Right. I say go back to equal standards. The reason why I'm going to proffer a possible reason why the ACLU has not bothered to file to have equal standards for the selective service. Because remember, we lost the ERA back in 1972, 73, 74, 75. Because when it came down to forcing women in combat, women voted against their own equality in the Constitution rather than have that forced upon them. I say start with equal standards. Is it true that your numbers of women in the military will drop drastically? Absolutely. But the women who are there will be physically qualified to do that aggressive work if you really want them to be in ground combat.
Well, also, is it true, Elizabeth Gill, that that this suit really represents most of the women in the military or just a selective number of women in the military?
Well, this suit, to respond to the Reverend, I mean, she keeps talking about equal opportunity, and that's, of course, what we're looking for. We are looking for equal opportunity for women in the armed services. All of our plaintiffs wanted to fight in the capacities that they fought in, and they wanted jobs that they can't have due to this combat exclusion policy. We're just looking for a chance for women to be able to compete, to have opportunities that men have now.
I've got a woman caller here that
I want to
put a woman caller on here because she's been waiting patiently and she's ex-military. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to say that I went in the military as an enlisted, and there is a very big disparity, and I'm a enlisted in officers, about how, not just how they're treated, but how they behave. And I'm making the assumption that all the plaintiffs are officers, and my point that I'd like to make is you can't have it both ways. As a feminist, I want every opportunity. I think that affirmative action has had its place, and it's over. If you can't do the job, you can't do the job physically. So if you want to be put in that category, pass the test.
Well, Zoe Bedell, though, what about the idea that you're separating yourself here from the officers, again, as opposed to the majority of those women who are in the service?
First of all, it's not accurate. We do have an enlisted soldier as one of the plaintiffs. Not that we're officers, but I'm not sure I entirely disagree with the caller in the sense that we are asking for that equal opportunity, exactly as she said. I'm not sure I understood what point she's making about wanting it both ways. We expect everyone to conduct themselves professionally. I've seen phenomenal behavior and conduct, and I look up to some of my own enlisted Marines, frankly. So I'm not sure I fully understand what point she was making there, but I would agree with her in the sense that equal opportunity is exactly what we're talking about as well.
The caller, Lisa, go ahead and respond.
Thank you. For clarification, if you can't pass the test, then you are going to be excluding many, many women from the opportunity to serve in the military at all. So that's
what I mean by affirmative action
versus equal opportunity.
Yep. No, and that makes sense. And I would just say, we need to have tests that hold people to the standards that are necessary for their jobs. If people can't pass tests, held the standards that are necessary for the jobs, they probably shouldn't be doing those jobs. But again, that's somewhat outside of the suit. We're just looking for equal opportunities to compete for positions that are closed.
Well, we're going to have to close it there because we come to the end of this hour. But I want to thank you, Zoe Bedell, Marine Captain, one of the four plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the Department of Defense. And thanks to Elizabeth Gill here in studio, staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. And thanks to Reverend Marie DeYoung, former chaplain and former commander in the U.S. Army and co-author of Women in Combat, Civic Duty or Military Responsibility. We'll continue to cover this and follow it as it progresses. And we also invite you to continue the discussion on our website by going to kqed.org/forum, clicking on the segment, or going to our Facebook page. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We're going to take up a different subject in the hour ahead. We're going to talk about the Bay Bridge design and opportunity to go into details with a couple of the architects who are involved in that, as well as others who will be joining us. And you're invited to join us as well. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Also, thanks to our interns, Bradley Davis, Riva Gold, Nora McCartan, and Gina Shalaba. And thanks to our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.